My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the West Portland Group. My strike date is February 5th, 1987. And very grateful to do this. Thanks for asking me. I appreciate being able to do this because anytime I can share a little bit of my experience with the idea that it may help somebody else, whether it actually helps anybody else or not, I don't know, but I know that it helps me. It enlarges my spiritual life and I grow. So I'm grateful for that. I ate something here a few hours ago, and I'm a little bit queasy, so I'm not quite 100%, but I'm going to give you everything I got. But so if I bear with me if I, you know, double over or something in the middle of my talk. Anyway, a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I started drinking at a very early age, and I drank for a total of 11 years. And for whatever reason, in those 11 years, my disease progressed very rapidly. In those 11 years, I was arrested 15 or 16 times for alcohol-related offenses. Nothing really criminal, just alcohol-related stuff. You know, assaulting bartenders, 3 DUIs, stuff like that. I went to 2 different treatment centers, was in detox. Became ultimately in the last year and a half or 2 years, my drinking became a daily oblivion drinker where I was drinking to unconsciousness and blackout on a daily basis, was no longer able to hold a job, and just totally out of control. And just to give you an idea where my head can still go sometimes today, about 2 or 3 years ago, I was speaking at a group down south from here, and I was outside the meeting before I started, and I was thinking about how I was going to get started, you know, in my talk, and I thought, well, I'll just kind of go through the, you know, the highlights, you know, 15 alcohol-related arrests, 3 DUIs, you know, became unemployable, you know, we'd get the DTs when I'd come off with alcohol in the end, 2 treatment centers, you know, lose control of bodily functions, so forth and so on. And then a little thing inside my head said, maybe I'm not really an alcoholic. But I recoiled from that thought as if from a hot flame, and I recoiled from it because of that reprieve that we have that the Big Book describes. Because at one time in my life, that's the exact kind of thought that would get me to go back to drinking. It was that insane thought that all of a sudden, it was like a team of litigators inside my head that would start off by saying, yeah, maybe I'm not an alcoholic. And then I'd start to prove and build a case on why I'm not, or maybe this time will be different, and I'd be drinking one more time again. But that wasn't the case this time because I did have that reprieve. But those things don't necessarily make me an alcoholic. Those things are just things that happened while drinking. They're probably a pretty good indication I have a problem with alcohol. But I want to tell you that when I wasn't drinking, I was filled with a sense of apartness all my life. I was somebody that was, I had just horrible loneliness even when I was amongst other people. I had waves of anxiety when there was nothing that I should feel anxious about. I had depression when there was nothing that I should be depressed about. I had a sense of impending insanity, always questioning. My mantra was like, something's wrong with me. What the hell's wrong with me? Over and over. I lived with a deep sense of guilt and shame when sometimes it was deserving from the, you know, the things that I'd done while drinking, but other times I just lived with it when there was nothing going on. Hypersensitive and hyper self-conscious. I was the type of person that if I was walking down the street and there was a restaurant full of people and I was sober, if those people in the restaurant turned and looked at me, I knew, I could almost, in my mind, I could hear them judging me and had the conversations they would have. But when I had a certain amount of alcohol, that didn't exist. A certain amount of alcohol gave me relief from that. I was like, early on it gave me relief, and later on in my drinking, it allowed me to become one of, not you guys, but one of those people out there, or it got me as close as I'd ever been. But early on it gave me relief. I was somebody, I was like a pressure cooker. I just had all this stuff. And then I'd have to drink, and it would just let the steam out. I've heard people say that they believe that that alcohol actually preserved their sanity. And I think I was one of those people. I think that had I not had alcohol, I would just totally snap. I think it literally saved my life because of, you know, drinking didn't cause my alcoholism. Alcoholism caused my drinking. And so anyway, alcohol was the solution to my problem. Later on, it became not just relief, but it allowed me to go out and participate in life and do the things that people seem to be able to do normally without anesthetizing themselves to the level that I had to. 10 drinks was my magic number. 10 drinks made me feel like what I thought other people felt like normally. And the fact of the matter is that if I was somebody that could have drank 10 drinks and maintained what 10 drinks did for me, I never would have come to Alcoholics Anonymous. The last thing is that piece of this whole thing that I believe makes me an alcoholic is that I suffer from that phenomenon of craving. And that is that once I have a certain amount of alcohol in my system, I can't maintain. There was a time where I was able to do it occasionally, able to maintain that glow, that buzz. But I got to the point where I would overdrink. And towards the end, it was almost every time that I drank. And, you know, it was that the phenomenon of craving that we, you know, as a class of people, were the only people that experienced. So I would get to my 10 drinks, and then I'd overshoot the mark and drink till oblivion, sometimes doing pitiful and incomprehensible, demoralizing things, other times just, you know, kind of desperate drunkenness. So anyway, I grew up here in Portland, and I was raised in a kind of a normal, dysfunctional family, I guess. We were, you know, and right away, even before I picked up my first drink, I seemed different than other people. I always wanted to be somebody other than myself. And one of the first escapes, even before I picked up my first drink, was in books. One of the things that I would do is I would get into books and just read and read. I mean, there was one book in particular, a novel that I read 7 times, that, you know, and I was just obsessed on the characters, trying to be like these characters, anything other than myself, because I always seemed to live, as far back as I can remember, with a certain discomfort in my own skin. And then when I found alcohol, it was magic. I was a blackout drinker right from the very beginning, and it did magic for me, and there was problems right from the beginning. Before I was even legally allowed to drive, I had wrecked my first car. I'd ran away from home under the influence of alcohol. By the time I was in high school, I was a daily drinker, by the way, from the very beginning. I used to tell my story. I used to say I was a daily drinker at the end of my drinking. That's not true. I was a daily drunk at the end of my drinking, but I was a daily drinker my entire drinking career. I drank in the morning before school. I drank after school. I went to a private prep school here in Portland, and that school, there was a lot of disposable income that a lot of these kids had, which, by the way, was one other thing that made me feel a little bit different then. I wasn't like these kids. I was not from a wealthy family, and yet I was amongst a lot of wealthy kids. One more thing that inflamed that constant feeling of different than and being alienated from. But as a result of the disposable income, we had tons of kegs. We had a keg every Thursday night. We had kegs every day after school on Fridays, and then we had keggers on Friday nights, and then keggers on Saturdays, and most of the time on Sundays. So I lived at keggers from Thursday through Sunday, and I drank at home the remainder of the week. And I got my first DUI when I was probably about 17, started encountering a little bit of trouble with the law occasionally at that time. When I got out of high school, I moved out of Portland and down into the Eugene area, and I went to work in the woods as a logger. And I went to, and I worked with some guys that were truly professional drinkers, and yet I stood out as the drunk. I actually embarrassed, you know, this logging crew at times. I mean, I got them kicked out of bars, and these guys were hard drinking guys, and they're all at least 10 years my senior. And, I think I mentioned I was kicked out of high school when I went to do that. And so the alcoholism, the drinking progressed. I mean, it was just continuing to progress. It was getting worse and worse. The blackouts were more frequent. But also what progressed was the sense of shame and guilt that came along with it, or maybe that existed anyway. I had this desperate feeling, you know, upon awakening each morning where I just lived with this constant guilt and shame and remorse. And then the loneliness. And like I said, I had the ability to feel lonely even when I was amongst people. But I just felt so isolated. I mean, I've heard somebody say that before, that they felt like they almost died of loneliness. And that was kind of my story. I felt like I almost died of loneliness. Anyway, after the woods experience, finally what happened is in the fall of 1985, I had a conversation with myself. I'd moved down to Ashland, Oregon, and I was walking down the street, and I had the conversation with myself, and I thought, you know, I have been trying to quit drinking or control my drinking, you know, for a long time now. And I'd made, I think, 30 days on my own, and which that was the only time I'd ever done that, with the exception of being when I was locked up. I used to do things where I'd like make these little plans. I'd take like 5x8 cards or 3x5 cards, and I would actually write how I was going to drink or what occasions it was acceptable to drink and so forth. And I just over and over and over could not control or enjoy my drinking. And so I had this conversation with myself at that time. I was like, you know, I've been struggling with this for some time now, and I'm done. I'm just going to accept the fact that I'm a drinker, and I'm going to drink however much I want, whenever I want, and just drink, and then quit fighting it. And what happened from there is, for probably the next 2 or maybe 3 months, it was probably the happiest I'd ever been in my life. The first 3 weeks of that, I drank and blacked out every day for 3 weeks. And what I found was my happiness in life rested in that type of drinking. Daily oblivion drinking. Throw away all responsibilities. See, I'm not one of these people that drinks and works. I'm somebody that just like drinks. I'm not a functioning alcoholic. You know, they talk about, you know, I've heard said that alcoholism is the only fatal progressive disease that has a fun phase, and that was my fun phase. And I believe in a way that it saved my life, because prior to this point, it was so much despair and depression and so forth in my life when I wasn't drinking, that it had not been for that little window of relief from my life, I don't know that I ever would have had the incentive to get sober when I did. Maybe not. But my speculation is I would not have. Anyway, that fun phase came to an end, and the problems started stacking up again. And I a little bit of trouble with the law here and there. And once again, I'm on the mission of trying to control and enjoy my drinking. And so, you know, I would, again, go out with the plans. I would do the different things. You know, I'd try to drink different drinks. You know, I'd switch from one drink to another. I tried drugs. And, you know, I'm a big advocate of singleness purpose. I believe that it's one of the most significant things in the fellowship that keeps groups whole. But I will tell you that, I'll tell you a little bit of my experience. It's part of my story with drugs, is that I tried to take drugs to solve my problem. And see, the problem is that I'm an alcoholic. I don't have an interest in getting high. I mean, high is fun sometimes. I mean, I had some fun times getting high on the few drug experiences I had. But that doesn't solve my problem. Alcohol was the solution to my problem. Alcohol did something for me. There's a big difference for me to having something that does something for me versus getting high. And to give you an example, smoking dope, for instance, I was somebody when I wasn't drinking that was, like I said, was very self-conscious, was full of anxiety, paranoia, depression, so forth. Alcohol fixed that. Smoking dope made that stuff worse. I was much more self-conscious. I was much more paranoid. In fact, my one marijuana in Southern Oregon, which is the, you know, one of the marijuana capitals of the world, I bought this big bag of weed thinking this is the solution to my alcohol problem. and smoke some of that, and I spent the rest of the day trying to drink out and drown out the effects of that. So anyway, I tried everything. You know, I tried eating different things. I tried drinking certain ways. I tried drinking on certain nights. I mean, I remember one night I had lost my driver's license, and I had hitchhiked from Ashland to Portland, and I was on the Greyhound bus back from Portland to Ashland, and I was contemplating my drinking problem on the way down. And between Portland and Ashland, they stopped in Eugene for a layover, I guess what they call it in the bus business. And anyway, so we stopped there, but prior to getting to Eugene, I had like the light bulb effect go on. If I only drink on Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, taper off with alcohol on Sunday, and then I only drink on the other night if there's a female involved to overcome any sort of fear I have for female, then that would probably be the solution to my problem. And, you know, sometimes and I had hundreds of these like plans like this, and looking back on them, they seem insane now. They seem really kind of stupid. Like, how could I believe that? But that, to me, is the definition of the insanity of this disease, because I would buy those plans hook, line, and sinker. But anyway, so I had this plan developed. We stopped in Eugene, and within 15 minutes of being in Eugene, I was sitting in the bar at the Greyhound station drinking with, you know, somebody else. I mean, that was the type of, you know, control I had over my drinking. Anyway, a series of things happened, and I'm leading right now into the last year of my drinking. My last year of drinking, of those 15 or 16 arrests, 9 of them occurred in that last 12 months. And in June of 1986, I came off of a really bad drunk. In Ashland, you know, the temperature is significantly different. It seemed like it was always 110 degrees down there, and there was bugs everywhere. I was always, you know, getting bugs out of my eyes and, you know, hallucinating these little gnats coming around like snot alcohol. But it was hot, I would be going through the alcohol withdrawal. I couldn't determine what the temperature was. I would be shivering on the inside like this, and yet, you know, it'd be over 100 degrees out. Anyway, I came to this one morning, and the night before I had done some sort of pitiful and incomprehensible thing, and I was just like, I was piecing together the night before and piecing together the blackout, and I was just like, oh God, I gotta get out of here, you know. I had just come off of an alcohol evaluation for my second DUI. My second DUI, I think. The court ordered me to do this alcohol evaluation. I went to the evaluation drunk, but I covered myself with enough cigarette smoke, chewing gum, cologne, and so forth that I don't think he noticed that I was drunk. But anyway, he diagnosed me as a middle-stage alcoholic, and I went through the questions. I said, well, what is it that makes somebody a late-stage alcoholic? You know, and he went through and was just like, check mark, check mark, check mark. And then he said, even some of the people come in here intoxicated. And I was just like, oh. So what I did is after coming off this drunk that night and realizing what I had done the night before, I went out on I-5 and I got out on the freeway and started hitchhiking north. And I was afraid of the DTs. I never had full-blown DTs, but I'd get some of the symptoms of DTs. I was somebody that, like when I'd come off of alcohol, I'd get auditory hallucinations. I'd be walking down the street, and I'd hear somebody's voice behind me. He'd go, Chris. I'd turn around, you know, nobody would be there. And I literally actually thought that everybody had that as part of a normal hangover. I never knew that that was alcohol withdrawal until after getting sober. But I was afraid that I was going to, you know, go into some hallucinations or start shaking or whatever it was that I was going to go into because of the amount of alcohol I was drinking. And so I had this plan to wean myself off. I hitchhiked up to Portland, and the first night I came up to Portland, I think I drank like 8 beers or something. The next night I drank 5 or 6 beers. The next night I drank like 3 beers. And then the next night, nothing. And then that night I just came apart. My mind started racing. My heart was palpitating. I was sweating, you know, and I felt as though I was going to burst out of my own skin. So I ended up checking into a detox, in downtown, and, I went into this detox. And as I mentioned, I've been detoxing now for like 3 or 4 days off with beer. Checking this detox, they kept me in the detox for 5 days on, Librium. They're monitoring my blood pressure around the clock, give me Librium. They wake me up, give me Librium. And, there was guys that were, you know, a good 25, 30 years older than me that were coming into the detox, detoxing for a day, seeing, you know, stuff come out of the wall and then being ejected into the treatment center that this detox was attached to. And yet they were still keeping me. These guys come in 1 or 2 days. I was still there 4 or 5 days later. And, I suddenly realized what this detox in this treatment center was doing. That this was some sort of elaborate conspiracy to make me think that I was a worse alcoholic than I really was. So they were holding me in this detox longer, you know, to convince me of this. And then when I got out of the detox, right prior to getting out of the detox, a physician gave me a physical, and on the physical it showed that I had this liver damage, and she explained to me that I had the liver of a 40 or 50 year old man that had been drinking hard for 25 years, and that there's 3 stages of cirrhosis, and I was in the last stage of liver damage before it actually became cirrhosis. And then if I kept drinking, I think at this time I was like 20 years old, I think, and they said if I kept drinking, I probably wouldn't live to be 25, or at least I'd have full-blown cirrhosis by age 25, definitely by 30. And I sat there listening to this, and I knew exactly what was happening. This was like the sales pitch of all sales pitch to get me to go into this treatment center. It was like those people that are closers on car lots. You know, they kind of warm you up a little bit, and then the real salesman comes and says, sign here. So I didn't buy off in any of that stuff, but I did end up staying in the treatment center they kept me in there for like 30 some odd days, and I stayed in there only because my insurance would not cover the detox unless I stayed for the inpatient. I stayed for the inpatient, and through that inpatient, I was exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous. And we were required to go to a certain amount of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings or Narcotics Anonymous meetings, and I went to both. And the Narcotics Anonymous meetings I actually preferred a little bit better because there was no identification that ever occurred. I could go in there and just sit there, and you know, the people were pretty hip and pretty cool, and I kind of liked them. But there was no chance of any sort of identification happening because I'm an alcoholic. And in the meetings that I went to of Alcoholics Anonymous at this time, there wasn't any identification in those meetings either, because those meetings lacked a primary purpose and they lacked a singleness of purpose. They were meetings where there was 2 different types of meetings that I attended while I was in there. One seemed to be kind of more of a, almost like a group therapy, where you would sit in a circle and people would go around the room and they would say, I've had a really good day today. Or I've had a really good week today. I've had a really bad week today. And then they go on and define what kind of week or what kind of day they've had. And there was very little solution in those. The other meetings I went through were some meetings where they would talk about the big book and they would talk about the stuff, but they didn't ever, there was no identification. They come out and say, every answer to your problem is in the first 164 pages of this big book, which I believe. Except for, I never identified with any of these people. They never shared a little of what it used to be like and what happened and what it was like now. I never had the sense that I drank like them, I felt like them, and I thought like them. Therefore, I'm actually going to pay attention to what the hell they're saying. Instead, I sat there and thought, yeah, that, you know, I want to quit drinking, but the thing that you don't understand is that I have to drink because I despise myself when I'm not drinking. I don't like the person I am. Alcohol allows me to become the person that I always wanted to be. I have to drink. And so I never got the message in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got out of the treatment center, hence I started drinking probably 10 days or so out of there, and I was off again. I ended up back down in Ashland, where I got my 3rd DUI soon after that. I was arrested another time, of all things, in Ashland again. My car got stolen, and I called the police. I was in a bar, and I called the police to report my car stolen because there was a couple guys sitting in my car waiting for me on the curb. And I called the police and told them, you know, they came and picked me up and took me down to the police station. And they said, we've already got the guys. We pulled them over right in front of the police station. And so we had them down there. So they drove me down there and they turned to me and they questioned these guys and they said, you know, they said, we're going to have to let these guys go because you gave them permission to sit in a car and, you know, and so forth. So they didn't really steal it, which is not true. They're 2 hitchhikers. And and I said, oh, okay. But then they turned to me and said, but you have the right to remain silent, and started reading my rights, and arrested me. And I was like, what am I being arrested for? And they arrested me for a parking ticket that I hadn't paid. And I was like, you gotta be kidding, you've thrown me in jail for a parking ticket? And they said, you can either get your fourth DUI, or you can go sit in jail and sober up on this parking ticket. So I went into, I don't know how I got off on this story, it's not really that relevant, but just to give you an idea where my life was, I went and sat in jail, and I tried to hang myself from the toilet of the, in the stall. It's not that funny, Paul. But it's difficult to hang yourself with sheets, I found. And, you know, and I threw a little baby fit in there, and, you know, I was somebody that was a cop fighter. Whenever I was arrested, I would always, you know, get in a fight. I was very mouthy and very physical with the police. I took some pretty good beatings from them. And, anyways, I spent the entire day in jail because I was arrested mid-morning. And, when I got out, you know what the first thing I did? I couldn't wait get down to the bar to tell everybody that I'd spent the day in jail, and I went back into drinking. Anyway, from there what happened is I did a geographic up to Alaska. I decided that I would go up and I'd go back to work in the woods as a logger. There was an advertisement in the paper for loggers, and it was on a dry logging camp. So I went up to Alaska. My intention was, I'm going to go up there, I'm going to, you know, dry out, quit drinking, put this whole thing, this whole alcoholism thing behind me, and get on with my life. And so I go up there, and for 3 weeks I'm working in this logging camp, and no alcohol. You know, it was an hour and a half float plane ride from the nearest tavern, and 3 weeks into it, these two guys show up with a bottle of whiskey. And I'm sitting in the bunkhouse one night, and they come in and they say, do you want some whiskey? And, you know, in my alcoholic mind is very quickly said, well, it's been 3 weeks. I haven't gone through any sort of DCs. I haven't had any cravings for alcohol. You know, everything seems to be okay. I'm probably not an alcoholic. Yes, I'll have one. So they hand me the bottle. I tipped the bottle up, and I went, gunk, gunk, gunk. And then they grabbed it, and they said, hey, you've got to make this last. They actually had planned on bringing that bottle and sipping on it every night. And I thought when they said, you want a drink, I thought we were going to sit there and drink the bottle. The problem is that I have that phenomenon of craving. And so I had an equivalent of probably about somewhere between 2 and 4 shots of whiskey, and I had nothing to drink. And I had nowhere to go to get anything to drink. The float planes came once a day in the morning. So I sat there throughout the night with just coming apart in my own skin. It was like an itch that couldn't be scratched. I wanted alcohol. And anyway, I made it through that, and I don't know if it was the very next morning or soon after that, a day or two, but anyway, I went and caught the float plane, went into Ketchikan, Alaska. First thing I did there is I left my bags at the float plane airport, and I went down to, there's a bar there called the Fo'c'sle. It's a legendary drinking bar. The Fo'c'sle is a place where, like, all the loggers and the fishermen come to drink and, you know, fight and knife each other and so forth. And just to give you an idea of what kind of bar it is, when you order a drink there, if you say you order Jim Beam, they give you the bottle with the glass on top. And anyway, I went in there with this guy named Dan. He and I sat down, and after, you know, 3, 4, 5 drinks into it, he turned to me and he said, so you think you're pretty badass, don't you? And then I went into a blackout from there, and the night erupted. I ended up in jail. And that was something else, by the way, I should mention, is that I used to have a huge tolerance for alcohol prior to this point. I was somebody that could drink 15 drinks, or 15 beers, 15 drinks, and go out and function and do fine. I might have a little bit of a slur, but I did pretty well on 15 drinks. I didn't run into problems until after that point. At this time in my life, I was starting to go into blackouts after the fourth drink. Sometimes. Not all the time. Sometimes I'd get up to where I was at 15 or 20 drinks, and I barely felt drunk. And other times, by the time I was my fourth drink, I'd slip into a blackout. And that was one of them. I had probably only had 5 drinks in me, and I was already in a blackout. Anyway, I ended up in jail that night. And as I mentioned, I was a cop fighter. I fought the cops going into the jail. And as they were throwing me into the cell, well, I'll skip forward. You guys don't need to know that part. they, anyway, I got in the cell. There's two other guys in this holding cell, and this is where there's a series of coincidences that started happening in my life that finally led me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And this was the first one, and that was, there's two other guys in this holding cell, and I took the lower bunk. There's a guy in the upper bunk and a guy in the single bunk across the, you know, the room. And when I came to in the morning, the guy on the top bunk was hanging off the top bunk looking at me, and I, you know, looked up at him and I said, you know, yes, can I help you? And he said, he goes, my name's so-and-so. He goes, I'm from Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, I've got 30 days sober and I'm doing 10 days of jail time. My sponsor made me come back and do it because I owed it to the jail. And I remember thinking at the time, I was like, you know, my God, I can't even get away from these AAs in here. but the reality is that there was something to that. I don't know how to describe that, but there was, like I said, it was a series of coincidences, and that was a part of this seed or part of the path that happened. Anyway, from there, I got out of Ketchikan. They let me out of jail later that day after going to court. Got on a plane back to Seattle. And as the plane was taking off from Ketchikan, not a single thought that alcohol was a problem. My thought as we were just taking off is, I will never go back to Alaska again. You know, it couldn't be anything, you know, other than something besides the, you know, the drinking. So I came from Alaska. I came back down. I owed 8 days of jail time down in Jackson County. And I went down to face the music for this third DUI. They sentenced me to 8 days in jail. I did my jail time on weekend, and so for the January of 1987, I spent each weekend checking on Friday. They released me on Sunday, did my 8 days, and on the between the third weekend and the fourth weekend during jail time, I was arrested on a Wednesday for drinking in public, and or drunkenness in public, And when the cops arrested me, what they said is they took me aside and they said, you know, and by this time, the Ashland Police Department knew me on a regular basis. I mean, and I didn't just get arrested in Ashland. I've been arrested from Ketchikan down to Ashland, Portland, Eugene, and so forth. But these guys knew me on a first name basis, and they took me aside and they said, you know, this is Mr. Clark. They said, you've got a hell of a drinking problem. You've got to do something about this. I mean, you're totally out of control. Go see this guy, Joe Fisher. He's an expert on alcoholism, and I knew who Joe was. He said, go see Joe Fisher. He's an expert on alcoholism. He can help you out. And I was like, yeah, right. And so anyway, the following day, I was walking down the street, and there was one of these sidewalk creatures down there. His name was Monty. I knew him from jail, too. And he would stand with like a Bible out on the street, and he would just read scripture to anybody that come by, you know. And so as I was coming by, he read something, and to this day I have no idea what it was. But I took a few more steps, and I thought somehow whatever he read seemed to tie into the cops saying to go see Joe Fisher. And I remember thinking, If I was one of those AA people, I would think, oh, there are no coincidences, and this is somehow a higher power at work in my life, and that I should actually take action on this and go see this Joe Fisher guy. I took a few more steps, and my next thought was, what if for once in my life I didn't rule these types of things as trivial and stupid, and actually followed through and did it, even though they seem illogical, trivial, and stupid. And so almost out of amusement, I turned around, I walked towards Joe Fisher's office. And I walked in, and Joe Fisher's secretary, she screened me, and Joe wouldn't see me until she came out, and she said, you know, what is it that you want? And I said, well, I've got a problem with alcohol, and I want to see Joe. And he immediately, you know, invited me in. My thought as I was going in to see Joe is, please, anything but Alcoholics Anonymous. Please tell me that you went to aversion therapy, 10 days, a couple 2-day follow-up. Now you've been sober 5 years and your life is wonderful. Because I wanted anything other than AA. I don't want to belong to a fellowship where they talk about God and held hands and did stuff like that. And, but, you know, I got in there and he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he did what a member of Alcoholics Anonymous would do. And he told me a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened, and what it was like now. And, at the end of his, pitch, he said, would you like to go to a meeting tonight? Now, I didn't want to go to a meeting that night, but I felt a sense of obligation because I did ask him to help to go. And so I went, only out of sense of obligation. Went in, it was a Thursday night Clay Street meeting in Ashland, Oregon, and, walked in, there's probably about 60 people back there. It was set up just like you're set up here, but bigger, and I sat in the very back, made my way around all the greeters so I didn't have to shake anybody's hands, and sat in the very back with Joe, and they asked about newcomers, so I did raise my hand and introduce myself as a newcomer. And this Clay Street meeting, the Clay Street group, was a primary purpose group, and they had a singleness of purpose in this group. When there was new people there, regardless of what, it was kind of a speaker participation meeting. So you'd hear the speaker, and then after the speaker, they would choose the topic, and then the participants would talk about the topic. But if there was somebody that was new there, they, would make it about the newcomer. And they would, each participant would share a little bit of what it used to be like, what happened to them, and how they got sober. And I'd never been to a meeting like this. I listened to the speaker, and then I started listening to the participants, and little by little, I started thinking, I drank like that. I felt like that. I thought like that. And then towards the end of the meeting, there was a guy, just maybe two or three rows in front of me, they called on him, his name was Frank, and he stood up, and he talked about coming out of the blackout with a revolver in his mouth, and then going back into the blackout, and then coming to the next morning on the floor with a revolver on the floor next to him. And I had exactly the same thing happen to me, except I had a knife. I came out of the blackout, and I was holding a knife on myself, and I went back into the blackout. I came to later on, sitting in the chair, you know, and almost the exact same story, except for I stabbed all the furniture to death somewhere in that blackout, too. But anyway, that kind of gave me goosebumps, because he'd experienced exactly the same thing. And anyway, I came out of that meeting of Clay Street, and... I should say, you know, this is so important for me, for my sobriety, that what they did for me. Because these meetings that I've been to around Portland, and I'm not saying all Portland meetings are bad, it just happened to be the ones that I were in, they did not have a primary purpose. This group did. And, you know, in the doctor's opinion, it talks about frothy emotional appeal will seldom suffice. That, you know, our messages have to have depth and weight. And talking about stuff is, to me, is frothy emotional appeal. But when you share, when other alcoholics share what it used to be like and what happened and what they're like now, that has depth and weight. There's no opinion in it for me. There's no opinion. It's just pure experience. I can't deny that people haven't gone down this path and suffered in the way they suffered that is similar to me and hit some sort of bottom that maybe on the outside looking in is very different from the type of bottom I hit, but they experienced the same emotions at that bottom, which drove them, that same despair and desperation that I had that drove me into this program is the same thing that drove them into this program. That's where the depth and weight is. So, you know, I owe my life to that Clay Street group. And, you know, and that's why in the groups that I'm involved with that, you know, I hold the flag of primary purpose and singleness of purpose high. I think that it's, for me, it is the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, after all, this is where we do our work, you know. And, so anyway. So after the Clay Street meeting, I had such a sense of hope. The first time in my life I ever had a hope. I stayed sober the entire next day. Did not take a drink. And that was miraculous. I hadn't gone a day without drinking, you know, for a long time. Now, I drank the next day because I didn't keep coming back. And I drank for about one more week after that. And on February 4th, 1987, I went out one more time to prove that I was different or that I was some sort of exempt alcoholic or that I wasn't an alcoholic. Or that I was an alcoholic that could somehow successfully drink. My plan was that I was going to drink 10 drinks no later than 10 or 11 o'clock that night. It was on a Thursday night, 10 or 11 o'clock, and I was going to shut it down, come home, and get up the next morning and be like a regular civilian. Now, the guy that was supposed to come and pick me up to take me to the bars this guy named Steve. He was a horrible drunk. And he was late picking me up. I drank 9 beers sitting in the window watching, waiting for him. So I'd already blown my plan by the time I'd left my house to go down to the bars. Went down to this bar called Jasmine's. I remember drinking vodka Collins in that bar. I was at the point where I had one hand over one eye to keep from seeing from double. I was in and out of a blackout. I ended up over at Cook's Tavern, which was my drinking establishment. Cook's Tavern was a bar where you could get away with anything. Anything went in this bar. I mean, there were low-bottom alcoholics. There was all sorts of deviant behavior that went on in this bar. Anything went. I sat down at the bar, and the bartender that night was a guy named Cliff. Somewhere in the middle of drinking at the bar, I had one of those light bulbs go off in my head where I thought, you know, the solution to my problem would be to become a bartender. If I was a bartender, then I could go in and work and drink at work and just go home. You know, I wouldn't have a car, you know, and so forth, and I could do this. So I talked to Cliff about this. And Cliff assured me that I was a shoe-in for a job at Cook's. And within, I don't know how much time later, Cliff had cut me off. I had pulled him across the bar, and I was about ready to work him over on the bar, but he weaseled his way away from me. He ran into a cooler, one of those big walking coolers, shut the door where there was a phone, and called the police. I found myself running through the streets, dashing through people's backyards. Police came, arrested me. I think I passed out behind some bushes, and they brought me to. As I was standing there, and the police hadn't cuffed me yet. They were saying something, but I had that tunnel vision going on. I couldn't see. I was, you know, that so drunk you can't see type stuff. And they were saying stuff to me, and I was just, something happened inside me. And I don't know why that was that night, because I'd been in much more serious problems and trouble than I had been in that night. But it was as if the straw that broke the camel's back, and I could not keep on going this way. And so one of the officers was standing with, and his revolver was on his belt, was near me, and I thought, what I'm going to do is I'm going to grab his revolver, and I'm going to shoot him, and I'm going to flee. And then my next thought was, no, I get caught and arrested for everything. I'll just end up being staying the rest of my life in prison. So I'm going to grab the revolver, and I'm going to shoot myself, because I can't keep going on this way. Now, I don't know if that was just a drunken thought or it was actually a serious thought that I would act on. I have no idea of knowing that. But anyway, before I could act on it, they cuffed me, took me down, and so forth. Later that night, they took me home, and I went into my bedroom, and as I was laying there in my bedroom, I was at a bottom. I was totally drunk, but something snapped inside me. And my last conscious thought was, I wonder if I'll feel this way when I come to in the morning, and I did. I could not stand living the way I was living. You know, death would have been a more attractive alternative than continue on living the existence that I was living. And death did not scare me. Had I had a crystal ball that morning that said, if you just keep drinking, you're going to be dead in 30 days, or if you just keep drinking, you'll be dead in 3 months, I would have just drank and died. My fear was that I was going to keep on living. I was going to live another 6 months or another year or another 5 or 10 years and just continue to spiral down this miserable existence that I had been living further and further and further. And so I cried out to a God that I didn't even necessarily believe in that morning or at least want to believe in. And I said, God, please make this stop or kill me. And I became willing to do whatever it took to stay sober. And I made the decision to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and do whatever they did in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew from that Clay Street meeting that I'd been at that there were people that drank the way I drank, felt the way I felt, and thought the way I thought that were staying sober. And so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was on February 5th of 1987. Now, interesting thing is, February 4th of 1987, I was somebody who lived with an obsession to drink on a daily basis, no matter what I drank. I could not drink, and it started in my mind. On February 5th, that obsession was removed, and I've never had it come back again. And I believe it's because I didn't know this at the time, but I believe that I did steps 1, 2, and 3 that morning. Now, I didn't do the third step out of the big book, say the prayer, but I believe in my heart I did it. I later on did the third step out of the book, but it was more of a mechanical kind of check off. I did that step. But that morning, I did the first 3 steps. I started going to camp. They told me in the groups in Ashland, they said go to 90 meetings in 90 days. get a big book, start reading the big book, get a sponsor, start working the steps. They told me also, and this isn't to make anybody angry, this is my experience, they told me not to read the 12x12 for your first 2 years of sobriety, to concentrate on the big book, and so I did. I immersed myself in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started going to meetings on a daily basis. I started doing all the things that they told me to do. And I was staying sober. When I was 14 days or so sober, I'm guessing, I had one of those moments of clarity or intuitive thoughts. And that was that, and this was part of my second step, and that is that it's always my thinking that leads me up to taking the drink. Thinking always precedes me drinking. And I turned my thinking, you know, at this time I still didn't know what step two was, but I turned my thinking over to God, the God I had no understanding of whatsoever. And I just said, please, from here on out, take my thinking. I can't think for myself from this point further. When I was 16 days sober, that guy Steve that was late picking me up in the bar, he was about 10 years older than me, and we debated back and forth for quite a while who was whose lower companion. And he really was a horrible alcoholic. He was going through, I ran into his girlfriend. He was going through DT, and he was, had locked himself up in this little, crappy cottage he lived in, which is kind of a skid row of his own design, and he's going through, DT, having all sorts of auditory hallucinations and so forth. And so I went over there. I couldn't sleep at night, you know, so I went over there in the middle of the night and stood outside his window and made noises that helped along his auditory hallucinations. The next night or two, I ended up over at his house, and he asked me about how I had gone 16 days without taking a drink. And I just read Working with Others, and I did what Working with Others said. He asked to go to a meeting. He went to a meeting, and he's over 20 years sober today. You know, so I'm truly of the belief you can carry the message no matter how much time you have. If you got 16 days, you can carry it to somebody that has 0 days. And that was a very big part of my sobriety. The groups that I belonged in, they were very, very tolerant and loving groups that I belonged in. Very solution oriented, but they're also tough love groups. You know, they said things like, you know, sit down, shut up, take the cotton out of your ears, stick it in your mouth, and listen. And I remember when I was about 30 days sober or so, I was as I was walking to go get some coffee or go to the restroom for the third or fourth time, they said, you know, if you're new, sit down, shut up, take the cotton out of your ears, stick it in your mouth, and listen. And I would think to myself, yeah, sit down and shut up to, you know, whoever they're talking to. And it wasn't until I was about 5 years sober, I was like, my God, I was the only newcomer there. They were talking to me. Yeah. But anyway, I got into this step. And what happened is, things went along fine for the first 44 days. And then after 44 days, I started experiencing severe anxiety attacks. I went to the hospital. The hospital tried to give me Valium. The group I belonged in had warned me about doctors trying to get alcoholic medication. They joked about, they said, and this is 1987, they said, you know, alcohol, our doctors had just discovered that alcoholism was caused by a Valium deficiency. So I knew not to take the Valium. But I was left with this, you know, this anxiety and craziness. And now, just to give you an idea of how crazy I was, now I'd done the first three steps, but I had not done the fourth step as of yet. And I took a psychology class, and I think I was about 6 or 7 months sober. And it's a big auditorium class. Professor was a guy who was in the program. He was sober 3 years at the time. And he gave us this test on stress, and it was to analyze how well we process stress. And we self-grade, we took it and we self-graded, and I was being honest, you know, because I'm an alcoholic now, and, you know, and so I'm taking this test, and we self-graded, and I, you know, we scored it. And he said, who here, afterwards, he said, okay, who here scored between 0 and 25? You know, and there's about 10% or 5% of the class raise their hand, and he says, you people, you know, you have virtually no stress in your life, or stress, you know, bounces off you like water off a duck. Who here scored between 25 and 50? And, you know, majority of the class raised their hand, and they said, you guys process stress as you should normally, and so forth. Who scored between 50 and 75. About, 25% of the remainder of the class raised their hand. And he said, you guys have, some stressors in your life, maybe midterms, maybe a major change in, move or something like that. Or you just don't process stress, as well as other people. And then he said, who scored between 75 and 100? And there was like two or three people. You probably went through a divorce, a death, something very major, significant stressor in your life. And, there's a handful of people that have that. Who scored between 100 and 125? Nobody. Who scored over 125? Nobody. And he explained, people that score above 125 typically are institutionalized or locked up in federal penitentiary. Now this concerned me because I scored 146 on this test, and I felt like I needed to be institutionalized. And so it gives you an idea of how crazy I was at this time. I went down and he explained to me, he said, anybody in their first year is going to experience that, the roller coaster of the emotions and so forth. And then we hinted that maybe I should get on to my fourth step, and which I still didn't do. And probably about a month later, I was having just feeling like I was falling apart. Here I am sober. And I started believing in God, started forming a relationship with a higher power. In one aspect of my life, things were starting to go well. I started to get a little bit of a conscious contact, but I still had this plague with these fears and anxieties. And I called this member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, I'm coming out of my skin. I'm having this anxiety attack. I don't know what to do. I'm probably about 9 months sober at this time. Now this guy probably never read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He probably didn't realize that what I suffered from was a spiritual malady. And that, that untreated alcoholism in a lot of times, especially in new people, manifests in anxiety and depression and so forth. And what he said is, he said, what you have is probably something other than alcoholism. And you have alcoholism, but this is something different. You should probably go see a doctor and get on some medication for this, because you're crazy. And I was. I laid in a fetal position every night in bed, saying the Lord's Prayer over and over and over to myself, because I knew I was going to be institutionalized at any moment. I felt so nuts. But anyway, when he told me that, I hit another bottom. When I hung up that phone, I thought, my God, I thought I had an answer in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought these spiritual principles would solve all my problems, and I thought I had an answer to my problem, and yet now I'm being told by a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to go take medication. I've been anesthetizing myself all my life. Last thing I want to do is go anesthetize my emotions again now that I'm sober. And so I made a decision there at that bottom that I was going to get on my fourth step, like everybody had been telling me over and over and over, and go through steps 4 through 12. And when I got to step 12, if I still felt this way, I was going to commit suicide. And so I went at it. I went into my fourth step, and I wrote an honest and thorough inventory. I got together with my sponsor to read my fifth step. I went through, and he did something very special, which is for me, and I always do with guys I sponsor, is that before I even sat down, he shared his deep, dark secrets with me. And so before I even opened my mouth and started reading my fifth step to him, there was identification. And I wasn't the only one that had done some of these, deviant, despicable things that I thought. I thought I was truly the only free person out there that had gotten away with some of the things I did. And what I found is that it's not true, that many people have done those things. Anyway, I read my fifth step to him, and about two-thirds of the way through my fifth step, we took a break, I used the restroom, and one of the things that I've been, a habit that I had formed whenever I was in the restroom for the last several years, when I was drinking and when I wasn't, but in this case, when I wasn't drinking, is I would go to the mirror and I would either tear myself down or I'd build myself up. And I would sit there and look at myself, and somewhere these feelings would originate from my soul. And that was, this is what's wrong with me, this is what's wrong with me, this is what's wrong with me, and I just, I'm just a piece of crap. Or I would build myself up, this is what's right with me, this is what's right with me, this is right. But that was fleeting, because that only lasts for a moment or two, and then I realized, nah, I'm not that. And I went to the mirror like I always did halfway through this fifth step, and I looked in the mirror, and that reaction, nothing happened. And I sat there, and I was like, what's going on with me? You know, what's this emotion or feeling that I'm feeling? And then it dawned on me, for the first time in my entire life, I felt comfortable without a certain amount of alcohol in my system. It was the first time I ever experienced comfort in my own skin without a certain amount of drink. And I went back, I finished my fifth step, I did step 6 and 7, and 2 or 3 weeks after that, I noticed I was walking down the street one day, and I thought, when was the last time I had an anxiety attack? And I started tracing it back. It was somewhere right before doing that fifth step. And it was like one of those, like they say, you know, nothing changed, but everything changed. Everything changed. I mean, everything inside me just seemed to shift. And that's where I became a believer in Alcoholics Anonymous as a solution to my alcoholism. Up to that point, I knew that it worked for drinking. But now I was finding that it worked as a design for living and really worked in my life. I became on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous at that point. Not because I'm somebody that's a joiner or a pitch man for any sort of organizations like this, but because it did so much for me. I went into steps 8 and 9, and as I was doing steps 8 and 9, you know, some self-worth started to build. Some self-esteem started to build. Not that I was trying to get self-worth or self-esteem. It was a byproduct of taking action. And that's what my sobriety has been all about. It's been taking actions that seem to have no relevance to my problem in the first place. And, you know, I'm the type of person that if I'm having interpersonal relationship problems with people, I need to go work with other alcoholics. If I'm having problems at work, I need to spend some time in step 10 and work with other alcoholics. My solutions are not a frontal assault. It's not going to marriage counseling and working on my marriage or working on my job. You know, I made a decision before step 2 that God is either everything or he's nothing, and what was my choice going to be? And then in the 9th step, it was promised to me that God was going to be able to do for me what I could not do for myself. And, you know, like Chuck Chamberlain used to say, he said, my business is to do his business, and his business is to take care of me. And that's the way it's been for me. Living in step 7 was a big deal for me, especially, well, all of my sobriety, but early on in my sobriety, some of those character defects that were, some character defects were lifted, some, a few were lifted, a lot were minimized, some of the power was taken out of them to where I could go out and live comfortably and still go back and address these character defects. And in addressing those character defects and living in step 7, I was told that, you know, that normal people have to feel their way into a new way of acting, or they feel their way into a new way of acting, or think their way into a new way of acting. And alcoholics, we have to act our way into a new way of feeling or a new way of thinking. And what they told me is to go out there and act as if God is removing these character defects, or act as if God is removing these fears, because he is. And so I started taking actions and walking through fears, doing things like, I was so afraid of people that, like, when I would order from food at, like, a restaurant, the waitress, I'd just sit and look at my menu and, you know, thank you. And so I started practicing looking at in people's eyes, tethered to God the whole time. In the 12x12, which I did read after I had 2 years of sobriety, you know, it says, God will not render us white as snow without our cooperation. And that's the cooperation for me, is to get out. I can't do the 7 stuff, turn things over to God, and then turn on the television set and expect God to magically come down with a magic wand and remove a character defect from me. I have to go out and start walking through the fire a little bit, tethered to God the whole time. So today in my life, you know, as many people say in AA, I made a plan, I would have sold myself short. Very true for me, and I'm very grateful to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's only been 2 things that have ever worked in my life: alcohol, a certain amount of alcohol worked, and a certain amount of Alcoholics Anonymous has worked. And there's no middle of the road solution for me, because the middle of the road solution filled with so much despair and uncomfortability that I have to do one of 2 things, and that is I need to either anesthetize myself with a certain amount of alcohol to get some relief, or I have to take a certain amount of spiritual action to get some relief. Everything in my life today is a result of this program. You know, I was taught very early on, first things first, and that's just as important today as it was when I got here. Everything I do in Alcoholics Anonymous today is the same things that I did when I, what I learned in my first year of sobriety. And I'm very grateful to be here, and grateful you have me. Thanks.